Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Wild Connection, the podcast where I connect you to our natural world through incredible conversations with scientists, authors, conservationists, and, well, anyone doing the hard work of communicating about this spectacular planet and all the life forms and systems on it. As you know, here at Wild Connection, we are dedicating the month of April to the Earth we live on, the Earth we need, and, well, the only Earth we have. We kicked off April with participatory science and Karen Cooper, followed by a reboot of my conversation with Nathaniel Popkin, author of To Reach the Spring. And this week, we are taking a journey with author Leah Rempe and discussing her new book, Earth and Soul, Reconnecting Amid Climate Chaos. Welcome to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm a scientist and author that studies animal behavior. I'm passionate about animals and exploring the complexity of their lives, their intelligence, relationships, families, social connections, and emotions. I also love helping people reconnect with nature to live better lives. This podcast is about you, other animals, and how we're all connected in this wild and crazy thing called life. Before we get started, I wanted to share a couple of pieces of exciting news. I'll soon be heading back to Uganda to continue my work with mountain gorillas. And if you want to donate to support that work and other projects, head over to my website, jennifervertelin.com, and click on Donate. All contributions are tax deductible. And while you're checking things out, sign up for the newsletter and subscribe to the podcast. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts. And you know what? Go all out and leave a review. That'll help me continue to bring you some of the best scientists and authors and make us one of the best nature podcasts out there. Listen, we are going deep today into the soulful realms of nature with Leah Rempe, author of Earth and Soul, Reconnecting Amid Climate Chaos. Get ready to be inspired, uplifted, and maybe even discover some new ways to reconnect with nature. All right, everybody, welcome back to Wild Connection, the podcast. This podcast is devoted to reconnecting with nature, so I'm thrilled to welcome Leah Rempe to the show to talk about her new book, Earth and Soul, Reconnecting Amid Climate Chaos. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. And just in that little brief intro, you've said so many things that really light me up, like connecting to nature, for instance. So I love to put a lot of exclamation marks on that concept and engagement.
Mm-hmm. It's so important. And this is why your book, I feel, is so timely and so critical. And before we talk about the book, though, I would love to orient my audience a little bit to who you are and a little bit of your background and how you came to write this particular book.
Sure. Yeah. Well, in a way, the book is a culmination of life experiences that I've had, and also deep interests that I've had for a while in how we reconnect to nature. Let's just start by saying that my professional career is quite varied, and I've worked in education, the corporations, working in the for-profit world. I've worked in the nonprofit world. I've run my own business doing executive coaching and leadership development work. So that part of my life has been rich and varied, and I feel really privileged to have done a lot of different things. The part that leads to the book, I think, has to do with spending some time trying to go deeper into understanding climate crisis and sharing information about that, being frustrated that we didn't seem to be willing and able to make the kind of changes that are so important, then being introduced to biodiversity for a livable climate and the whole concept of biodiversity, ecosystem, species loss, which became really then near and dear to my heart. Because if we were able to wave a magic wand, of course, you know, and stop all of the emissions and all the burning of fossil fuels, if we were not living with, loving, and caring for the living world around us, it still would be a tragic, tragic thing for Earth and for all of us who live on her. So I got really interested in that. And then as I was leading retreats, I kept coming up with the question, like, how will we live in these times? So there's the whole question of what can we do? And I'm also interested in the question of who will we be? You know, yeah. How will we manage to be as courageous and caring and attentive and collaborative as we need to be to have ourselves both as thriving to the degree we can, but also really supporting the whole idea of mutual thriving for this world.
Yeah.
That was a little long, but that's kind of what brought me to, I have to write this. And in part, Jennifer, I was writing it because I was trying to figure it out.
Well, Leah, I thank you for sharing all of that. And I think that that touches on so many different aspects that we're going to talk about. One of the things I wanted to kind of get your perspective on, since you've moved in different spaces throughout your career, and I've noticed over time that conversations around the environment have grown more economically focused, meaning everything in nature has a price tag, and that's why we should value it. And that's diametrically opposed to even the title of your book, mm-hmm. Earth and Soul, right? And the idea that we are nature, we are inherently connected to it and to each other through it. So what are your thoughts about this economic valuation of nature, which from my perspective hasn't done much to help us protect nature?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that we become passionate about collaborating with the living world and trying to understand how to aid her in continuing to offer this incredible life we've had on this planet. I don't think we get really passionate about it by numbers, you know, by thinking about it as ownership and property and what we can use and can we consume more and how productive can we be. So that's why soul is in the title of the book, because I think this requires of us some deep introspection about who we are individually as well as collectively, who we are, why we're here, what is our contribution to make in these times? And, you know, Jennifer, it's paradoxical because we're holding that as an individual at the same time saying that we are so interwoven in this living world that we cannot possibly be separated yeah. from the world, right? I mean, yeah. we know we don't go very long without air or water or food. And how more connected could you be than to say you are breathing together, right? You are drinking the rivers. They are in our bodies. And, you know, the photosynthesis occurring in the plants are fueling who we are. We cannot be disconnected. And yet our language and our kind of our dominant Western culture tends to speak as if all of that is other. Yeah. And when we other something, then we lose that deep caring, that heart connection. And yeah. it becomes, I think it allows us to move into that economic discussion. So I suspect we're, you know, putting exclamation marks on each other's thoughts around
absolutely
this.
And throughout this book I was like yes and you know, for me, the thing that drives me is exactly what you just said. This, when we see something as other, and it could be a plant or a person, we lose the capacity to have empathy and understand our interrelationship. So everything that I've always tried to do is I zoomorphize people, because we are animals and we like to think we're in this hierarchical relationship with everything else and even each other. And so by showing the similarities and highlighting more of the similarities than the differences in our behaviors and our life problems and our social dramas, because I study behavior, there's an opportunity for people to go, oh, well, that squirrel is having a conflict with that neighbor. I don't like my neighbor very much. And all of a sudden, the squirrel becomes very, more similar to you than other. And mm-hmm. you also brought up westernized, predominantly westernized perspective. And in the book, Earth and Soul, you talk a lot about indigenous perspectives and how important are they when it comes to reevaluating our relationship with the natural world and with reconnecting with nature.
So, you know, I want to be clear that I am a learner at the feet of Indigenous and land-based peoples. I don't claim extensive knowledge, but I do claim a lot of admiration for the wisdom that appeals to me, that I see in the way that, you know, we could take in the way that Indigenous peoples in what's now the United States managed forests, for instance. I mean, what we know about that is that that was a very careful and important way of taking actions that were for the good of the forest and the good of the people. So there was looking for that commonality, that possibility. It feels a lot like we look now for, well, who's going to win and who's going to lose, right? Rather than that, you know, how will we be fit to live with and live together? How can we fit ourselves to that, that place this time? Anyway, so I think that the indigenous peoples have a lot to teach us about a different paradigm, a different way of thinking about our relationship to the world around us. And there is a stream of greed that is justifiable if we are doing enough othering and making plants, animals, land. If we make that other, then we can justify continuing to live as we do, which makes it really hard to want to change.
Yeah.
You know, so I love what you're saying about inviting us into, you know, not anthropomorphizing plants and animals are like humans, but how are we like the plants and animals. I love that.
Yeah.
You know, that whole idea of anthropomorphizing has been one that I've kind of struggled with. And I've kind of come to say, the reason I don't want to do it is not because I think I'm so superior to, but because I don't want to deny the unique intelligence.
Yeah.
You know, that is not intelligence that I can understand. And I know that's a lot of the kind of work you've been doing.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I always try to tell people we do not have the market on frustration, jealousy, love, you know, embarrassment even. I've seen that a few times, what I interpret to be, but it's very recognizable, you know, and this is why so many people you know, if when you ask them about their dog or their cat, when they cohabitate with another animal, they have no problem making that leap. But when they see a sandhill crane, you know, out in nature, suddenly it's an other. And that's because they can't relate to it because they're not cohabitating with it. I like what you were, you know, you spent a lot of time talking about forests and in the book, and I have all, and you just, you know, kind of brought that in when we thinking about how indigenous peoples, they weren't, they didn't have zero impact on the landscape, but it was a thoughtful impact on the landscape. And I've always thought of plants as magical beings, and people really underestimate their intrinsic value. And you bring up a lot of really wonderful elements of plants in terms of like communication between plants and cooperation between plants. And I always feel calm and peaceful in most forests. And it's where, for me, my mind becomes quiet. And I'm curious, you know, what do you think is special about forests that we can really integrate into our lives? What is something that we can do to tap into that experience of being in a forest surrounded by trees?
So, gosh, this is a hard question because so many answers are kind of flooding through my mind. I don't know if you know this, but I am just in the very final putting the last periods on what will go off to our publisher, a book I'm writing, co-authoring with a colleague on the spiritual wisdom of trees.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's wonderful.
So you set me up very well for that. And of course, so that means that what I've been writing more recently is all about trees and forests and, you know, the gifts that they are. So let me not say too much about that, but let me see if I can drop in a couple of ways that we could think about responding to your question. First of all, you know, there's a reason why people are so drawn lately to the idea of forest bathing. And I think there is, especially in an old growth forest, there is something that just invites a dropping of your breath, you know, feeling your feet on that spongy floor. There is just you know, it's a combination, I think, of awe and wonder, which takes us out of our small self, you know, and situates us in a larger context, letting kind of those immediate worries all about, you know, the things that seem so important, letting them dissolve away for a bit and being caught by this beauty and wonder. I mean, of a sequoia or a redwood. I mean, any of those things are, you know, in an old growth forest are just incredibly awe-inspiring, and they capture us. So they take us out of ourselves is one thing, and help us remember that we're part of something larger. There's the specifics of, you know, the aerosols that are passed from tree to tree, that there's, you know, that they use to send messages. So sure, a lot of the messages are sent underground through the fungal network, and they're also sent through aerosols. Well, we're breathing those, you know. So I have to say, there's a part in the book where I say, I wonder what they're saying about me as I, you know, because if we were insects attacking, they would be sending messages like, you know, get that chemical going, you know, that will rid the, well, if you're an acacia tree in the plains of the African continent, they'd be sending messages to say, you know, put that out there so those giraffes are going to move on.
Right.
And so what do they say when we wonder? So there's so many studies, and they're really fun to read about, where if you can see a tree outside of your hospital room, then people who are recovering from lung surgery, I believe it is, recover much more quickly. We know that in cities where there are more trees, there's less violence. It's also incredibly cooler. So let's just say that could be a contribution. So I think there's many ways, you know, we can think of the awe and wonder, the beauty, the calmness, the actual physical offerings that they're giving us. And I also want to raise a flag for us that it's not just about taking from the trees. So that whole idea, and this is made, I think, beautifully apparent in Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass, the reciprocity. Yep. What are we called to? What are we responsible for giving back?
Yeah.
So my flag is always, if it is about we go into the woods because we feel better. Yes, I do think we do. So let's celebrate that. And then what is it we might want to return? What are we called to return? What does a tree want from us? What does a tree need? Is it protection? Is it water? Is it thank you?
Right. Is it quiet?
Yeah, stop talking, Leah. You know, I mean.
No. No, but I'm thinking of the people that run through the forest blasting their music without considering the impact on not just the plants, but on other animals, the level of noise that we bring into these forests.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, why wouldn't we expect that living beings are appreciative of appreciation, right?
Right.
So. So I think there are things we can learn metaphorically from trees. You know, we talk about sometimes about trees. They really know who they are. They're not trying to be a different tree. They're not trying to be more than what they're given to be. So there's a lot of metaphors. You know, they are resilient. They weave around trying to search for the light. Or, you know, they cover up their wounds with burls. They drop branches when they're no longer able to support them. They drop leaves when they don't have enough water. I mean, so they're adapting all the time to what the environment is like. And think about even when trees fall in the forest. I think the whole concept of death in a tree is so interesting. Here's a fallen tree, and what happens if we leave it alone?
Yeah.
It turns oftentimes into a nurse log.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so
habitat
then,
for other things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Or those snags that we leave, you know, where woodpeckers and squirrels and, you know, they can make their homes. So there's a lot of giving going on. So I think metaphorically, there's so much to learn in that way, just to really try to understand how other living beings, this is what you do with animals, right? You know, and I think as you're telling the stories of animals, like I might be telling the stories of trees, it's like, oh, wow, there's a lesson for me there.
Sure.
And I think it's also that we can connect. So it's not strictly metaphorical.
Yeah.
It's a wordless connection because we can't. Now, some of the animals, we may be able to invite them into small conversations, but the trees are not going to really say a whole lot in English for us.
Right. And neither are the animals, but they say a lot, you know, just the way they are. And I love what you said about the tree isn't trying to be a different kind of tree. Every time I see another animal, I always think about it embodies and embraces what it is. It may be trying to be the best bird that it is trying to be, but it is not trying to be a different bird.
Right.
It is, right. You know, and I think that for me, whether it's watching other animals or walking through a forest, I'm very present. I'm completely present. Mm-hmm. And that just happens. I know that if I'm not present, I trip, I fall. Certain, you know, body movements don't coordinate properly because I'm distracted. by either thoughts or, and I can be in conversation and be present. So it's really interesting, but forests are definitely for me, my, where I calm down. And, you know, right now I work in windy, impenetrable forest, and it is indeed impenetrable. And when you were talking about it, I wonder what the plants think about, you know, me, elephants, gorillas, and other animals are trampling through, right? Mm-hmm. And the trackers that I work with, when I don't go into the forest for a few days and they see me, they're like, oh, you need to come in the forest. Like, because I think I start twitching or I become agitated. And, yeah. And you know, if I don't walk every day outside where I might see a woodpecker, a squirrel, a blade of grass, a bush, a flower, anything, I start to get, you know, agitated by the existence of our the way our modern society works. And, you know, I engage in science and use it as a tool to share information about the lives and needs of other animals. But at the end of the day, I'm really just an observer. And I've always felt this enormously deep privilege that other animals let me be a witness to their lives. And I will be clear, they let me because I don't intervene in the, I don't do experiments anymore. I did with prairie dogs and some experiences I had with how some individual prairie dogs responded forever stopped me from trapping, marking, and doing anything invasive like that. And it's interesting because over the years of being with animals in various environments, funny things have happened. And where it's clear to me, we're in a relationship. And for example, right now I'm studying mountain gorillas in Uganda, and one of them in particular watches me as intently as I watch him. And other, all the trackers go, ah, he sees you with your yellow notebook. He knows it's you. Or if he seems agitated, they're like, you go, he'll calm down. And he likes you, right? So they have an understanding of him as an individual and his temperament and his behavior. And sometimes I put the notebook down and I just sit there resting while he rests. And in those moments, you know, I feel that communion, and I have felt it with other animals. And I wish other people could have that experience. Yeah. What is communion from your point of view what you write about in the book Earth and Soul? And why is it so important to cultivate our connection in this way?
Yeah. So I'm using the word communion as a beyond word connection. I think about how so much of what we hear and see and feel in the world is filtered through our heart. And then our heart sends messages to the brain. So, however, I will say what I learned to do is really focus on the logic and the rational way of interpreting information and giving it back. So that's what I'm trying to address in my own way of being, is to use my senses, to use my heart connections in ways that open more avenues for understanding. We know that we can connect by heart and we can communicate that way. We know that because we do it. If I'm sitting in a room with you and your eyes well up as you're telling me a story, or even if you're not talking and your eyes well up, I know that I feel that same way. So that's what I'm looking for, is how do we make those kinds of connections? Because they allow us to connect beyond words. There's a term that's been coined, and I wish I could remember right now in real time who used it, but the term is species loneliness. Oh. So you ask why? I believe that we are lonely, for those connections to humans for sure, and to other living beings around us. We're, you know, it's not been that many years ago that people had to understand the animals in their forest that they were walking in, that they had to know where the water was coming from and what was safe and what was not, that they had to be able to interpret the weather and what kind of storms might be coming. That was a way of life, and you didn't live if you were not able to do that. So that's deep within us, you know, is this sense that we are connected in some way. And when we, you know, the little that I've read about indigenous peoples in the Amazon, for instance, they do not understand how you speak of forest as being separate from you and your community. It just does not show up as something that is different. And but we've got words that separate us. So why is it important? I think we remain forever lonely if we don't find that way of reconnecting.
I completely agree with you. And while you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, in the forest where I'm working, the indigenous Batwa were removed from the forest. And when I was sitting with one of the clan leaders, I had him on the podcast, we talked about, they live right next to the forest, but they are not permitted in the forest. And so every day they're looking at what their connection was and that they don't have. And when you ask, you know, what is the feeling you have? It's homesickness. They're right next to their home and they're lonely for being in their home and being with each other. Mm-hmm. So that really, I think that people don't realize, like in our sort of modern westernized culture and in many other places in the world, how deeply lonely they are and what the cause of that loneliness is. Mm-hmm. I mean, right? We have 8 billion people on the planet. How could you possibly be lonely? In cities, people are lonelier than in smaller rural communities. And I know that that's a product of many things. One of them is disconnection from nature. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, and you can see in higher economic neighborhoods, you have more trees, you have more green spaces, and people don't necessarily make the connection between that, why they feel good there. They might think it's because they have a bigger house, but it could be just because they have more animals and trees. But, you know, that also brings up something. Because you had a story of rats, and
yes, I did.
And I love rats. They really have empathy for other rats, and you can cultivate a lack of empathy in rats by raising them in a certain way. Mm. But you know, I remember talking about nature with a podcast guest a few years ago during our Earth Week, and I remarked about how nature is messy. Okay, And so that's what, when I was reading Earth and Soul, I was reminded of that conversation because you had a story of rats. And in my courses, I teach about how organized nature that's neat and orderly was something imported by European colonizers and has its roots in Judeo-Christianity and the relationship with, quote, wilderness. And so how do you think, and how did you embrace the mess of nature? And why would it benefit us to accept nature is messy?
Oh my goodness. What a great question. So, you know, there was something that occurred to me I hadn't really thought about as you were talking. And what occurred to me is if I'm out walking in the garden or I'm out walking in a forest, there are all sorts of things there. And it's not that I am going like, oh my God, there's a rat. You know, I've got to leave this area. I'm not necessarily going to go befriend it because it's not my it's not my spirit animal.
Right.
But I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep over it. I'm not gonna worry about it. That's what happens. There's snakes, for instance. You know, we know what wonderful creatures they are and all the good they can do. There, you know, I'm just wondering if there's something about building a house and claiming it as mine, you know, that is a way of distancing myself. And there's that whole idea, right, of ownership of land or property or whatever, because there's some way in which coming into my house feels like a violation in some way. And, you know, I mentioned the ick factor, ick factor rises, you know, we had this was years and years ago. We lived in Australia for a couple of years and we were doing tent camping out, by what was then called Ayers Rock, Uluru. And there was, I guess it happens occasionally, there was kind of this extra large number of field mice. They were running all over. And as we were camping, they were climbing over sleeping bags, in and out of your tent, you know, wrapping up the string that had been around the sleeping bag and trying to make a nest out of it. I mean, just everywhere. I didn't love it. It's made for kind of an interesting story.
Sure.
That would feel totally different in my house.
Yes.
Yeah. So I don't know, Jennifer. I'm just kind of trying to probe this as you were talking about it. Like, I feel like that's something I need to explore.
Well, yeah. I will say this. In your house is very different than outside of your house. And I think that people want that order that they have inside their house to extend outside of their house. Mm. Now, I think it's very, very natural to have a sense of property. I mean, other animals do. I've been attacked by a hummingbird because I was sitting too close to its bush. Mm-hmm. I was pelted with pine cones by a squirrel because I was sitting under its tree. Mm-hmm. Her tree, right? I certainly have experienced other animals reacting like, hey, why are you here? Right? You're mm-hmm. in my space. You're in my place. They have, I know people can't see me, but they have responses that they don't want other things in their burrows. They don't. I tried to put a camera, bury a camera in a prairie dog burrow, and this female dug it out and tossed it, I don't know how many feet in the air. Like, get that out of here. What are you doing? So I think that's a very normal reaction, right? And I have that too. I had a giant grasshopper fall out of my ceiling fan. And I was like, it landed on my bed. And I looked at it and I said, no, you don't get to stay. But I didn't kill it. I caught it and put it outside.
Yeah.
Like go find somewhere else to be. And spiders, I let them stay. We have an agreement. If they agree not to come into the bed, they're welcome to stay. The minute I find you on my bed, now you're invited to leave the house. Mm-hmm. So, right. And I think cultures all over the world, from historic, you know, anatomically modern communities to today, are like, okay, there's some things we don't want in the house. It's our space, our territory. It helps us feel safe and secure. And that's something that I think is just part of being alive, whether you're a rat or a human. It's the outside. I've noticed people are like, oh, I don't want the javelina to eat my strawberries. What do I do? Don't plant strawberries.
Mm-hmm. Or plant enough.
Right. Yeah. You know,
plant enough for both.
Yeah. And so I think having that, and this reminds me of a beaver that was in, it was a very affluent neighborhood. I used to go walk there because there were so many birds and trees. And there was a beaver that was taking up building her lodge, you know, in a stream, and all one day the landscapers came and they just destroyed the whole thing because messy, right? It was a messy pile of things. Yeah. And so that's, you know, like, I agree, having a rat infestation is just not something you want. We can understand why they might utilize human materials and human spaces the same way we do it. You know, they can't modify their environment to the extent that we can. So they're capitalizing on that. But I mean, the outside nature is messy. Right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And can we learn to leave it that way?
Well, I think it's messy. And I also think we have judgments that are really, let me give you an example of where messy, I think, is really problematic for some people. And that is a native plant.
Oh, yes.
And so, yeah, so we have a little group called Save Our Soil. And some of the tenants of that are around, you know, trying to support people who are doing regenerative agriculture, local food, growing our own. But it's also, we have a little program we call Lawns to Life. You know, can we take even half of those spaces that are dedicated to grass, which often requires things like fertilizing and excess water, and then there's the runoff, and it, you know, anyway, we could go on about that, but could you just take half and make a home for butterflies and bees, all the pollinators, the birds? But you know what? Those do not look like the gardens, put that in quote, that people are used to. That whole European idea of controlling the landscape around us.
Yeah.
And I mean, like the Versailles European, you know, like it's going to be very controlled in the hedges and, you know, and better if you've imported specific plants, because there's some status to, you know, having collected them from all over the world.
Yeah.
Whereas when we're talking about planting native plants, we're doing it because it supports the native critters. And so, you know, how many HOAs have we heard about where there is this big argument about the fact that it does not look the way we think it should look?
Yep.
You know, so we teach, you know, when we do our little slideshows and talk to people, we tell them that we didn't invent this term, but somebody did, cues of care, right? So you can put little signs, or maybe you can have a nice little border around it with rocks so that it shows that it's intentional and not that you are just a very sloppy homeowner who doesn't care about their yard. But the idea that we have to have these conversations is just a kind of small way of pointing at what you're saying, is that then we're trying to impose some sense of order. Control is maybe the word.
Yeah.
Some sense of control over the look and feel of the world around us.
Yeah. And I think that helps us maybe feel internally, I know I'm going off on a tangent here, more control over our lives in a way that we can't ever have. There's just so much uncertainty in life, and we try to impose certainty anywhere we can.
Yeah.
Which is so interesting, because you also talk about, and I know, you know, I know you're busy, so we'll sort of shift to something that I think we're leading into. You talk about eco-anxiety, and I think for me, it's grief more than anxiety, almost like an unbearable sadness at what I know is happening and will continue to happen. And I guess, you know, how can we, and someone like me, I would say that I'm not entirely hopeful. And it makes me really sad. Mm-hmm. You know, the suffering that I see, whether it's a raccoon on the side of the road or the beaver who ultimately moved her home and got hit by a car. An entire species that will go away. how can we overcome this sense of hopelessness that one person, me, can't make a difference in a sea of indifference?
Yeah. Well, it's such a great question. And it's in part what I was trying to wrestle with, you know, when I was writing to try to understand what I felt and thought and, you know, what others were saying about this very question. So I want to separate grief and hope for a minute. I know that all our emotions, you know, we have so many emotions around this topic and they all live together. But for a minute, if we pull out grief, I think there is no way to ignore the grief. It is only living into it that we can do. And so the question becomes, what kind of support do we need so that we can let our hearts break open and think about the tragedy of that beaver who has no home now and then was moved to a new place? I mean, that is tragic. That is tragic, especially when we know how important beavers are for making magic.
Yeah.
To find water where there isn't any. You know, I don't even know how you bring beavers into the places that they come in and there's nothing there. And then there's wetlands. I mean, they are amazing. They are miracle workers. So it is tragic. And the question that I'm trying to ask is, how will we hold that? How do we hold that? We're going to have to mourn that. Because we know in the rest of our lives, we can't just ignore the loss of a loved one. You know, it isn't like, let's find some closure and get over it. You know, it's going to be with you. The loss of that loved one is going to be with you for your life. And the challenge we have now is we're having loss upon loss upon loss. And they're accelerating and we don't see an end in sight. So what are the really spiritual practices, I think, that we cultivate to hold that grief? And it has to be done together. You know, we have to start, I think, finding some ways that we can create rituals for bringing humans together to mourn the loss of the beaver, and also going out into the world and mourning with Earth for what is being lost.
Yeah.
So mourning is, I think, the right, or, you know, I talk about bearing witness, not looking away, looking on to it, but it requires a lot of heart work to do that. And that's why I say there's an and with it. And the and with that is to also support ourselves through awe and wonder and beauty and those deep connections, because they are true also.
Yeah.
And so we, to me, just in terms of how we hold all of that, there's going to be times we're going to be really deep in grief and times we're going to, you know, need to put that on the back burner long enough to go do something that restores ourselves and then allow ourselves to continue the grief. So yeah. That's one thing.
Okay.
Hope, I think, for me, and I thought a lot about this because it's such a common question. You know, the minute you start talking about climate, usually what I get is, but there's hope, right? You know, and I think sometimes we say that as if we mean nothing will change. Right. If, like, we're just going through a period of time, somehow we're going to come back to this equilibrium. And I keep saying, you know, the glaciers that we melted are not coming back. Yep. You know, the forests that are burned down, this is a million year process to get those to, you know, with us staying out of the way, you know, and not contributing more. Right. So no, if that's what you mean by hope, that we can keep living as we are and not keep losing the world, the answer is no. Correct. If hope means that the living world around us has agency and intelligence and is working for its own restoration and renewal in ways beyond our understanding, then I think we can say we don't exactly know how our contributions will help. We're going to listen as deeply as we can to what we think. Let's take a forest, what we think that forest wants and the direction that forest is heading. And we're going to do all we can to contribute to that kind of co-creation with that living world. And it may not manifest in our lifetime. In fact, it probably won't. So we are trusting. That's, I think, what hope is. We are trusting that if I do what I'm called to do and you do what you're called to do, we are laying stepping stones. We're planting little seeds. And our prayer, our hope is that people of the future are going to pick those up and keep helping with that harvest.
Right.
You know, because it is a multi-generational collaborative that is required of people in Earth, I think, to bring us back to a time of well-being. Well, maybe back to a time isn't even the right word. Bring us to a time of well-being for all. Because for a long time, the well-being has been, for me, at your expense. It's part of that othering, back to that othering we were talking about. Right. So that was really a long answer, but it's one I've just tried to struggle with myself. What does that mean to hope? And I think we do have some allies there in this effort who have been around much, much longer than our human species, you know, who have seen 5 great extinctions, some of them, you know.
Right. I know. And so I think that's a really great place to leave the audience holding that. If I may, I would just like to contribute how, and this is for that beaver, since she has come up in this podcast, the way that I honored her life is I invited several friends of mine to help me bury her where she had been building her home. So I couldn't bear to have her just on the side of the road. It just bothered me so much. And so somehow I asked, hey, would anybody like to help me bury a body? And people responded. They didn't know it was a beaver, which raises another issue. But we took her and I buried her. And that was what I chose to do for her and for me. It helped me like I did something good in what turned into a really bad situation and what was very, where I was mourning her. And the interesting thing is the three of us are forever connected over that event. And my request to invite people to help me do that for her. And, you know, so I struggle with the hope and I like, you know, I'm going to contemplate a lot of what you just said about that. And I really think, you know, that the audience should get Earth and Soul Reconnecting Amid Climate Chaos. It's such a heartfelt book. It's clear that you put yourself in there and became vulnerable. And inviting everybody on this journey with you. So thank you for being here and for sharing with me.
Oh, Jennifer. Well, first of all, I just want to say that story. Thank you for sharing that, because I think that's exactly what I'm hoping I will be brave enough to do and courageous enough to do, which is to bear witness in that way and bring people together to create a ritual. And in doing so, honor this life that was lost and also offer a potential ritual for others, you know, to use, to make that an okay thing, because that's countercultural.
Oh, very.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm wondering what people thought body was going to be buried. But that, yes, as you said, that's another story. There's a book in there somewhere. But I do think It's so beautiful. And I'm so glad you shared that. And I've just loved talking with you. I'm so grateful for the opportunity. And I'm so appreciative of all the work that you're doing and the way in which you're doing it. So I feel like I found a kindred spirit in that way. So thank you for that.
Me too. Thank you so much. A huge thanks to Leah Rampe for sharing her wisdom and insights with us. If you're feeling inspired to deepen your connection with nature after today's episode, be sure to check out her book, Earth and Soul, Reconnecting Amid Climate Chaos. You can find links on the show notes and at jennifervertelin.com. We're also now on YouTube at Wild Connection TV or on the podcast website, Wild Connection, the podcast, hosted by Podbean. Before I tell you what's coming up on the next episode, a little more news. Thanks to the support of the U.S. Embassy in Kampala, in addition to the mountain guerrilla work, I'm launching a new environmental education project in Uganda focused on tackling, you guessed it, plastic pollution. This initiative will connect students in the U.S. with their peers in Uganda to collaboratively address this pressing issue. If you'd like to support this project or contribute to our other conservation efforts, including the Mountain Gorilla Research, you can go to my website and click donate, or you can visit wildconnection.org and donate from there. Remember, all donations are tax deductible and go towards education, conservation, and community engagement. We've already gotten some generous donations of equipment, including 2 Acumen microscopes. Okay, next week, we're continuing our Earth Month theme for the last episode of the month and reconnecting with nature by thinking about other ways to nurture our relationship with the environment with acclaimed author Lydia Millett. Until then, stay wild and keep spreading those Earth Day vibes. Thanks for listening.